You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Before we get into the podcast, ladies and gentlemen, football season is here. And if you think you know your teams, if you think you know the game and you want to make some money off that, well, we got DraftKings.com. They are a sponsor of The Brian Callen Show, proud to announce. Look, if you've already been scouting for players for your season-long team, use that knowledge and you can win instant cash at DraftKings.com. Last year, one player turned $11 into $4,000, and I hear another player won $1 million in one day. That's just by playing fantasy football. If you really think you know the game, if you really think you could be a coach, then put your money where your mouth is, all right? And fantasy football is way more exciting at DraftKings.com, and I'll tell you why, because you can win huge cash starting the first week. And DraftKings.com, here's the good thing. If you use promo code Callen, C-A-L-L-E-N, you'll get free entry into the week one $5 million kickoff bash. See how I said that? Space that out. Enter Callen for free entry now at DraftKings.com. DraftKings.com. All right, ladies and gentlemen, this is the Brian Callen, Hunter Motz. This is the, we don't know what the name of the show is, but we're trying slowly to be like, this is Interviews with Brian Callen. It doesn't matter. Our guest is Dr. Lewis Dartnell. He is a UK, as in United Kingdom, Space Agency Research Fellow at the University of, how do you say that, Leicester?
Leicester.
Of course, Leicester, of course.
As and, Leicester Square.
Indeed. And writes regularly for The New Scientist, BBC Focus, BBC Sky at Night, and Cosmos, as well as for newspapers, including The London Times, The Guardian, and The New York Times. He's won several awards, including the Daily Telegraph Young Science Writer Award. He also makes regular TV appearances and has been featured on BBC Horizon, etc., etc., etc. And he's only 32 years old. He's a young doctor. Ladies and gentlemen, which means he's very smart. You've written this book, really fun, The Knowledge, How to Rebuild the World from Scratch. And I got to tell you, I learned a lot. I it's basically, everybody writes these sort of post-apocalyptic books, but yeah. This is kind of like, listen, if we forget everything, this is how you make everything from acid to how you grow food to how you make clothing. We take so much for granted, man. We take so much for granted. My friend has a joke where he says, if I throw you in the woods with an axe, see how long it takes you to send me an email. we are the product of many, many years of experimentation and stuff. Yeah. What got you to write this book?
I think it was just that. It was curiosity, plain and simple. And I've just been having this kind of this idea, this notion bubbling away in the back of my head that if you had to, if there was some kind of apocalypse, and I don't think there is one coming, and I'm certainly not some kind of doomsayer, it's just the starting point for thought experiment. But let's imagine that scenario does happen, and you find yourself right back to the basics. How do you start everything from scratch? And like you're saying, I think a lot of us living in the modern world today have this, kind of growing sense of disconnect with how things are done, how things are made, and how the kind of civilization that we've built for ourselves, supports us, the kind of life support system of the modern world. And I just wanted to peel all that back and go right back to basics and say, look, how do you do things for yourself? How do you make food for yourself? How do you make the materials for yourself, or the substances that we all just use every day without realizing and take for granted? How was that done? How does our world actually work?
That's exactly right. I mean, for me, it was less about getting ready for the apocalypse, but realizing how much I take for granted and just how difficult it was just etching out a living before you could rely on so many other people and the work of so many different structures. And, just like the way you describe acid and what sulfuric acid is and what that compound is and how so many things are derived from sulfuric acid, where it comes from, how we might make it if everything is, I think you start with pyrite. There's different ways.
So sulfuric acid is one of these things that you would not believe the number of things that sulfuric acid is used for in the modern world. It's the kind of linchpin of all the chemistry we do to support our everyday lives. And most people don't realize that. Yeah. So if you did have to go back to scratch, how would you start making these basic substances for yourself. And it's not just things like sulfuric acid. It's things like potash or soda ash, which have been used for millennia, for centuries and centuries and centuries. And they use in everything from making soap or making paper or making glass, you know, just making the basic stuff that you need to use every day. How could you go back and do that for yourself? So, I mean, the book, like I said, the book isn't really about the apocalypse at all. It's about how our world works and how civilization progressed and developed over the millennia, over the thousands of years, and how you can kind of leapfrog through that process of recovery if you have had to do it from scratch. You know, how could you accelerate the reboot of a civilization from scratch with the right knowledge, with a kind of a guidebook that directs you to take shortcuts? And that's what I've tried to write with the knowledge. And if you just look through the acknowledgements of the book, you know, that there's 200 people that I kind of mentioned there. There's several hundred books and kind of leaflets and websites and references that I've referred to gather all this information together. So it was certainly a labor of love. It took me, I think it was almost 3 years from first sitting down to think about this properly, rather than just, as I say, bubbling in the back of my mind, to handing in the final manuscript to the publishers. So it was certainly a long process of kind of condensing everything down.
Well, I love this stuff, because I always think about these things. And this is where I want to go with this. If I put you on an ark, I give you 10 people. I'm putting you on the ark. The flood is coming. You got 10.
Heck.
And then I'm going to give you, let's call it, all right, whatever. I'll give you 10 compounds, whatever it is, to bring with you.
Or items.
Yes.
Or items. I want, go, give them to me. The flood, I can see the tsunami coming, man. Get on the boat. Get on the boat. We got 2 minutes.
Apocalyptic survival team.
Yeah.
I think if you're trying to repopulate the world afterwards, 10 people is going to be too few.
Forget that repopulate. Well, I'll have you, yes. Well, I mean, let's be very chauvinistic about it. It'll be 10 men, and we just have a lot of, the whole bottom is just women who are ready to.
The Doctor Strange love.
That's the Doctor Strange love thing, exactly. We've got to have breeding women of breeding, you know, age and willing and loose morals. I give you all that. Don't worry about repopulating. I'm talking about you've got to have a team of scientists or a team of people with the knowledge. You can only bring 10 to do all the things we talked about.
Practical skills as well. If you got to choose which team you took through with you, you'd want to have someone who was a farmer or a horticulturist. You knew how to kind of grow food. You'd want someone who's very kind of practical and good with their hands, like, you know, an ironsmith or a carpenter. You want someone with some medical knowledge, like a kind of a doctor or nurse. So it wouldn't just be scientists. Scientists would help you rediscover stuff afterwards, but you would really want people with kind of practical, you know, hands-on direct skills to help your society, to help your culture keep going in the meantime. And the kind of tools that you would need would be, again, the kind of things that we know of, we're familiar with the words, but we don't really know how to use them.
Right.
And this would be everything from like a plow or a harrow to work the ground and make food come out of it, to a loom, which is how you weave, make clothes for yourself.
Right.
You want some kind of, you know, kind of distillation equipment to make beer and spirits and ethanol, which you can use for a whole range of different processes. So it would be all these kind of tools that have been used throughout history, and you just don't see in your everyday life anymore. You know, you can't go into a 7-Eleven and pick up a plow anymore. But if the plows were to disappear, you would starve to death.
In
short order. So it's about this. The book is all about kind of reconnecting ourselves with the fundamentals of our lives and how it's been done throughout history. And I think just, you know, enjoying that kind of process of exploration. And it's not just the book. I've taken a lot of time to construct a website that you can explore, which is the-knowledge.org. The-knowledge.org.
I love it. The-knowledge.org. So, okay, good. And not the word hyphen, but the symbol hyphen.
Exactly. So the dash knowledge.
Yes, the-knowledge.com.
It's because the knowledge one word was already taken, truth be told.
Yes.
There's a whole load of kind of how-to guides on there, and videos that I've recorded showing you kind of fun stuff, like if you're in a survival situation, how can you open a can if you have no can opener? How can you start a fire if you have no matches or lighter, but you don't have to rub sticks together?
How do you do it? I love that. I need this. I'm going to that website. I really do obsess about this stuff. I love it. I live in Los Angeles. The nearest forest is 30 miles away, but listen, if the shit hits the fan, I got to be ready.
When the earthquake comes, you guys are going to need the skills when the earthquake comes.
That's right.
Right.
And that the astounding thing, and I show this in the video, you can start a fire with a fire alarm, which you would normally associate with, you know, detecting fires or warning you of them, and something you just rummage around underneath any sink in any kitchen in the world, and you get some steel wool, some kind of wire wool, and using a fire alarm and some wire wool, you can start a fire for yourself, or even something like a bottle of water, which would use to put out a fire. Used in the right way, you can start a fire with a bottle of water.
Wow.
And so it's all these kind of neat little tricks, which you can watch on the video.
Yeah, I can just see a bunch of pyros. Like, you know, ah, this guy's amazing! I love this website! Thanks, Darnell! Cops are like, hey, bro, stop with the fire knowledge, all right? I mean, it's kind of incredible, though. I love that stuff. We are so hopelessly unprepared, most of us, for if anything goes wrong. We are so... We're so dependent on the grid.
I think you're right. Once the grid goes down and the supermarkets start running empty, you're going to need to have a bit of knowledge, a bit of a kind of acumen around about yourself to keep going.
Fire is a huge thing. I've been hunting in very cold climates, and you without fire, you're done. Good luck.
It's
miserable.
Survival thing. It's not just, you know, survivalists and preppers and kind of being out in the wilderness and cooking food for yourself. Fire is used in everything in civilization. You need fire to make metals, get metal rock. You need fire to work those metals to make tools. You need fire to kind of produce the substances that you rely upon. Even something as baking limestone or chalk to get lime out of it. You've got to have a fire. You've got to have this thermal energy to kind of run those processes for you. And even today, you don't really see fire much anymore. You might have a gas stove that you cook your dinner on, or you might have an electric stove. But every time you get into your car or your truck, it's an incredibly, you know, exquisite way that technology has harnessed fire. These little bursts of fire in the engine from the fuel is what drives your car. So we're still as reliant on fire today as we were 10,000 years ago, huddled around a campfire, you know, in caveman.
It's just, it gives you a lot of respect for being aware of just what you come from and how lucky we are.
Over time as a species, you know, one of my great joys of writing this book was discovering the kind of innovation and resilience and resourcefulness of people throughout history and how we've kind of achieved all this stuff over the centuries. One of my favorite facts from the book was how you can run a car, not by using petrol or diesel, not using fossil fuels, but using wood. You can run a car using wood as fuel. And again, this isn't some kind of, you know, cranky, speculative stuff. This was a very important process during the Second World War in Europe with all the fuel shortages. And there are over a million wood-powered cars, so gasifier-powered cars across Europe. And the German army even had a division of tanks that were wood-powered rather than diesel powered. And it's this kind of technology that you would want to fall back to and kind of catch yourself so you don't regress too far before your society can start pulling itself back up by its own bootstraps and, you know, getting back to the kind of level that we're at. If you wanted to, of course.
Yeah. And has it changed your notion of human potential? Does it, you know, whenever I think about that does seem to be the fundamental difference between the human animal and other animals, the word potential. Our ability to, you know, continue to evolve that way and surprise ourselves with not only innovation, but how we use other innovative ideas and build on them.
Tool users, aren't we? One of the defining characteristics of humans is our adeptness at using tools. And there are other examples in the animal kingdom, like chimpanzees and some crows use tools as well. But it's the incredible diversity of things, artifacts that we make for ourselves and then combine in new ways to make new technology and new machinery that kind of drives us forward. And I say this is the kind of story of hopefulness that comes out of the knowledge that even if we were to lose everything, and I truly hope we don't, but even if we were to lose everything, I have a lot of confidence, a lot of optimism that we would very soon kind of start picking ourselves back up, brushing off the dust, and get on with kind of recovering. Because again, there's lessons from history where we've done similar things after, you know, kind of bubonic plague in Europe in the 1300s. Society continued and people got on with their stuff because they appreciated these things and understood these things that we've kind of lost nowadays.
It just sounds like a video. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Well, and I was going to say, I mean, in terms of that resourcefulness, I love the story about the Yugoslav impromptu hydroelectric plants that they set up. Could you tell that story for our listeners?
Yeah.
Yeah, this is great. There's a photo in the book of a city called Gorazda in Bosnia, and it was isolated during the Bosnian war. And they continue to receive kind of medical drops and food drops from the NATO, from the UN. But they're completely isolated from the grid. They had no electricity. And again, it's this incredible example of human resourcefulness and, you know, kind of jury rigging. You've got a TV show called Scrap Heap Challenge or Junkyard Wars or something, haven't you? Mm-hmm. And it's this for real. They did junkyard wars for real in this city. And they jury rigged hydroelectric turbines for themselves, which they threw over into the river, tethered to the bridges. They used the alternator, which you can get out of any car engine, any truck engine, as a kind of ready-to-go generator for creating electricity for yourself. And there's a photo of these hydroelectric turbines they created. And they say it's this kind of stuff that you could use with your resourcefulness to keep yourself going, and jury-rigging wind turbines to kind of recharge deep cycle batteries to keep your lifestyle electrified.
Well, you know, it sounds crazy, but maybe because I live in Hollywood, I keep thinking about what kind of a movie this would make. You know, everything is done, and it's just the two of you, and you find this book called The Knowledge. Who the hell is this guy, Lewis Dart? Now this is crazy. All right, I'll thumb through it. Now let's rebuild society.
And then worship kind of Lewis Dartnell as a god.
Yeah. Now it's Lewis Dartnell the god. Exactly. You know, it really does feel like it would make. Have you ever thought about a screenplay?
So we're working through a. Like science documentaries based on this idea. We've optioned that to TV producers. And I am talking to kind of sci-fi film producers as well. So as you say, the ideas are very kind of common, and there's great tropes of this post-apocalyptic world that people are talking about. And, you know, there's plenty of films like I Am Legend or The Road.
Yeah.
And again, I'll plug the website one last time. But I've got the top 30 post-apocalyptic sci-fi films you need to watch. So you can go to the website and you can click on any of those.
And that is the-knowledge.org?
That's the one, exactly. Yeah. So you can see my recommended list of films or of books, of kind of free audio downloads and all the kind of videos you can watch.
I'll be all over that because I love... One of the things I like, there's a book called Cold Mountain. Mm-hmm. And yeah. In the book, the author does a really good job of just showing you back in the day how, for example, they used a pig, and it's from nose to tail for everything, you know, for to how to render the lard and everything.
Yeah. And make animals out of the fat and use them for many different applications.
Exactly. And so how incredibly manual everything was, existence was, if you lived in a log cabin in the wilderness. Just how to ferment things, all those kinds of things, how to prepare for the winter.
Yeah.
You know, those are the things that none of us really worry about anymore. Most of our hands are not. You can imagine what their – I think about things like that, what their hands felt like. Have you ever
– Alex.
Yeah. If you've ever shaken a farmer's hand, I did a I was did this thing called Discovery Sports. It didn't last very long. Apparently, I didn't test well with women. But I was hosting the show. Apparently, I'm sleazy.
Who would have thought with your reproducing plan? After the world, when all the women are there to repopulate,
it must have been the lustful look in my eye, kind of 24/7. But there's this event called pumpkin chunking, where these farmers create these catapults and shoot pumpkins a mile, whatever. Yeah. But every hand I shook was literally. I've never felt like I was like, well, sorry, I play the piano. I didn't know what to say about my tiny hands and these massive. You know, you see these guys. Even if they were 5'4", they had these like it was like grabbing a cluster of bananas or something. And I always wonder about. I always think about just, you know, how soft we've become, and more importantly, like you said, just how much we take for granted. We don't know the stuff because we don't need to know it, or at least we think we don't. So.
That's exactly it. Or at least someone else knows it and does it for us.
Right.
Or it's done more efficiently with a machine today that would have been done with people in the past.
Yeah.
But I always think that's the interesting thing is people always talk about how you don't need to reinvent the wheel, right? Mm-hmm. We already know how cars work, they're there and all that sort of stuff. But I think that it's going through the process of reinventing the wheel that makes you appreciate the wheel.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's really what the knowledge does is when you realize how much work it would take to get back to square one.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, we've talked about this before. I use my phone every day. have no idea why or how it works. I take medicine. I don't know how. I don't even know what medicine really is. I've read up on it. It's a molecule, and it reacts with my body a certain way. Yeah. But I don't know what that means, really. I don't know how medicine is made. Mm-hmm. I don't know how aspirin is rendered from willow bark. I don't know anything. You know, I know women.
Something that would be really, really important to try and get back to as quickly as possible. Because without that, you know, the slightest pinprick on your finger, you could end up dying from several days later. As people were doing, you know, into the 1930s and 1940s. And then the scary thing is we're kind of starting to return to that stage now. A lot of antibiotics are starting to lose their effectiveness because of resistance amongst the bacteria.
That's right.
Because of abuse. Because we've misused the antibiotics.
We're creating these superbugs, these bacteria, that flesh-eating bacteria that we can't stop. Yeah. That's the kind of stuff that you worry about. It's almost like we're coming... the need for innovation, the need to sort of... break from old models and come up with completely new ideas is never ending. It's just, it's part of evolution, you know. But certainly we're not going to be able to do that without having an understanding of where we came from, because it seems that this kind of stuff just builds on itself over and over. Isn't that what you found for the most part, that there were certain seminal ideas that then gave rise to an entire industry?
Well, this is it. What I talk about in the book are things called, what I call gateway technologies, the kind of things you want to get back to as quickly as you physically can, because they'll help so many other areas of your society and kind of accelerate things. And so clearly something like electricity would be a really useful thing for many different areas of life. And again, something like the printing press. Once you've got a printing press, you can reproduce information for everyone in your society. And kind of knowledge itself becomes democratic. It's not being copied out by hand by some monks.
And let me ask you this, because when you talk about, let's say, let me take the 10 most important people of the millennia. You know, if you look at these lists, sometimes you'll get Shakespeare and Copernicus and Galileo and Einstein and Freud and I guess Karl Marx as far as a seminal thinker who moved up. I don't like him, but you know, whatever. But you know, you can go through all these sort of different people that were considered not only seminal thinkers, but people who revolutionized in some way or another the human condition. I would imagine, though, when you write a book like this and you're looking at not only the gateway technologies, but the people that came up with this gateway technology, do you have a different idea and sense of who the 10 most important people of the last 500 years are, or for example, or 100 years?
Well, that was something I actually deliberately tried to avoid. I didn't want the knowledge to become a history book of a bunch of dates and names of famous people who discovered things or invented things. Because I think, for me, the interesting story is the kind of inventions themselves. I wanted to give them a personality and a kind of a characteristic and explain what were the important stepping stones in the progression of humanity, but not linger too long on the names of people that did it. Because if you're doing it all over from scratch again, you know, it'd be a completely different name. And
sure.
And if you're keeping to the premise of the book, and the difficulty in writing the book was keeping to my own conceit, which is it's a book for after the apocalypse and rebooting civilization, but always making it interesting, relevant to someone today. Because, like I say, I want people to read it today, and it isn't really about the apocalypse in the end. So you can't really have nothing but kind of names and dates of people, because that would, you know, blatantly be irrelevant if you're trying to do it for yourself. So things like the internal combustion engine, the motor that runs all the cars and trucks and delivery vans that we drive. What I found absolutely fascinating was that it's not really one invention. It's this vast, you know, aggregate of other inventions. And you can look at the different bits and pieces, different components that make up the engine, from the piston to the flywheel to the camshaft and the cranks, and all these things. Each of them kind of stretches back through history for different periods of time, and some of them are invented, you know, in a Roman water wheel. Some of them go back to kind of ancient pottery wheels. Mm-hmm. Some of them go back to kind of sand timers and clock technology. And all these things just were brought together to create this engine that now runs the modern world. And I'd say it's this kind of fusion of technologies and ideas that is is the beat of the drum that we kind of move to as civilization progresses.
And isn't it also, I mean, so much of it is that the idea of the seminal figure who invented these things is really says more about the limits of our intelligence as individuals than about the intelligence of these seminal figures. What I mean is that, you know, there were lots and lots of people who contributed to the development of the light bulb, but we single out Edison because it's easier to remember one name than to remember that, oh, Humphrey Davy came up with this thing that didn't really work.
Tesla.
And then Tesla, and then they had arc lights, but arc lights were too bright. And so then, you know, Edison went to J.P. Morgan and got a bunch of money, and there were a bunch of inventors whose names we don't remember who worked in his factory. And then it was improved over the course of the next 100 years, way beyond the original carbonized bamboo.
Morse code is another example of that. Yeah. He was actually an artist who worked with people who were studying electromagnetic fields.
Yeah. I mean, that's exactly the history that we remember, and the kind of heroes that get noted down in the books. It's just a grossly simplified story, and everyone at the end of the day is standing on the shoulder of giants. Everyone's kind of been helped and aided and supported by people at their time and working in the same research lab.
Yeah, that's what Isaac Newton said, the great scientist. I'm standing on the shoulders of giants. And I think he said something like, I'm a child skipping rocks across a sea of knowledge or something like that. The idea that if you look at the vast effort that's been made to bring me to where I am essentially like a child. I'm skipping a rock along. You know, there's so much to know that I'm touching. I'm skipping. You know, with a piece. It's pretty cool metaphor. Pretty humbling. You know,
it is.
I'm not that humble.
Brian, did you invent comedy?
Yeah, I did.
There had never been laughter before you.
I am the funniest.
Yeah.
I said that last night in my stand-up. I said, you know, it's a very peculiar skill set to be a stand-up comic. It doesn't make me feel like a man. It's not something that was needed back in the day, but I think I'm funnier than most of the great men in history. I was like, even Jesus. I mean, I'm sure he was better at me than everything, but I'm funnier than the Lord. Because I've read the Bible. He wasn't that funny. Everybody was like, what is this guy doing?
This guy's, take that one.
They actually laughed, thank God. But,
yeah.
But that's...
I think that's one of the jokes. It's very much on the knife edge, isn't it? It could go either of two ways.
But books like this are humbling. They're important because you do understand that you're, you know, look, less so in the UK, but certainly in the United States and the American ethos, the idea is that you are an individual. You're the oak tree. You're the oak tree, man. You can change time. Time is linear, and there's one man, you can change everything. And there's merit to that. It does move things forward. It does create a culture of innovation.
It's empowering, isn't it?
It is, but man, does a book like this put things in perspective. It puts things in perspective. you realize that you're just a tiny leaf on a very big tree. In my case, I'm a lot shinier than most leaves, but so what? Back to you, though. Back to the knowledge.
I think that's it. I think that the one thing I try to get across in the book was this vast architecture of science, the things that we know, and technology, how we apply that knowledge to make things, to make machinery or kind of processes to make our life easier. And they obviously all interlink and kind of interact with each other. And that the question I was trying to answer was, how can you navigate a shortcut, take an optimum route through this vast network of science and inventions and get from A to B as quickly as possible? You know, if you had some kind of map to the territory,
yeah,
could you take a shortcut?
I love the you open with these fragments I have shored against my ruins. T.S. Eliot, The Wasteland. Why did you choose that?
I think it's a beautiful quote. This it was actually given to me by my agent. He was the one that kind of drew my attention to it. And again, I swear there is more on this website than there is in the book. And one of the blog posts on the website is an app you can download and listen to T.S. Eliot himself read The Wasteland. And honest to God, this is a spine-tingling thing to listen to. It's one of the most awe-inspiring poems that you can ever hear. Yeah. Or you can also listen to Viggo Mortensen, who's obviously one of the actors from Lord of the Rings.
We call him Viggo Mortensen here, but I like Mortensen. It sounds really good.
There you go. I'm probably grossly
mispronounced. No, I like it. I'm gonna start calling myself Brian Ka-Len. It sounds more ka half an.
Are you from Kryptonite?
Len. Yeah. I love the. I wish. I envy your. You speak the original English, so I envy you. But keep going.
The Queen's English.
Yes.
So imagine Aragorn, reading to you this epic poetry of the wastelands. It is absolutely spine tingling. So yeah, I chose that for the quote for the entire book, because I think it summed up the thing I was trying to achieve absolutely beautifully about what could you preserve, what kernels of all that we know would be the most crucial things you want to save if all else is lost.
Yeah.
I loved what you said in the book about Richard Feynman and what he thought the single sentence would be that you needed to pass on to future generations, and then your rebuttal to that. Would you mind telling us about that?
Yeah, this was the idea of how can you encapsulate or condense down the kind of vast sum total of human knowledge and boil it down to the most crucial kind of nuggets, the kind of kernels of knowledge that you could then explore later. And the great physicist Richard Feynman was considering exactly this problem, the idea of how you can kind of recover after some great global catastrophe. And his single sentence, the one thing that he would preserve above all else, was the atomic hypothesis, this idea that everything in the world and everything in the universe is made out of these tiny little particles, atoms, which are flying around and sometimes attracting each other, sometimes repelling. And you can explain an enormous amount of the kind of physics with that simple theory. But my point was that that's not really going to help you in a kind of direct, practical sense. If you really are not right back to basics, what is going to be the most useful information for keeping yourself alive and helping you pull yourself back up by your bootstraps and rebooting a civilization as quickly as possible? So in the book, in the knowledge, I basically turn Feynman's single sentence into a complete 300-page book and look at lots of areas and look at lots of different kernels of knowledge you'd want to preserve and then kind of unpack and tease apart later down the line over the generations as your society is recovering and progressing and you're trying to reboot, you know, civilization and science alongside each other.
Well, and what I think I might have read it on a blog post that you wrote on the website, the-knowledge.org, that, you know, you were also saying that it was really the scientific method was the single concept that was going to allow you to make the most progress rather than a specific finding of the scientific.
That's exactly. Rather than trying to record all of the facts and figures and the theories and the knowledge that we have today, the best thing you can do is record the way that you can find out for yourself from scratch, all over again.
And well, I think that's as relevant today as it ever has been. You have 40% of our country, from some statistics, I don't know, you know, I haven't read them all, that actually believe that evolution is not really something to be taken very seriously. Darwin's theory of evolution is apparently, just a theory and shouldn't be taken. You know, let's talk about intelligent design and the Bible. I mean, it's pretty amazing.
It is an astounding fact, and it is of concern. But what worries me even more is people that are against vaccinations, the kind of anti-vaxxer movement, because this isn't just a theory. This isn't just I believe in evolution or I don't believe in evolution. This is not vaccinating your children and protecting them from communicable diseases.
I know.
And people are dying of stuff that we basically solved, you know, 100 years ago, 50 years ago. People are now dying of these things again, because of what I believe to be misguided points of view and opinions of the parents making decisions on behalf of their children and endangering them. And with a little bit of understanding, a little bit of appreciation of what science is, and science isn't just a collection of facts, it's a way of deciding what is a good explanation and what is a bad explanation for something, what is a good course of action and what is a bad course of action. And not vaccinating your kids is a ludicrously ill-advised course of action in terms of keeping them alive.
Couldn't agree more. Amen to that. And it's amazing how many people, how many people have a problem. We had Paul Offit on, Dr. Paul Offit on, wrote a book called Do You Believe in Magic? And he talks about, you know, this alternative health movement. And he's very careful. He said, you know, there are a lot of people that don't vaccinate their children that choose to do these alternative cancer therapies. And look, I'm not defending mainstream pharmaceutical medicine. They do a lot of things that aren't – there are a lot of people that die from drugs that maybe aren't as good for them. We don't have a central database in this country. I don't want to get into that. But there is no question that when we move away from the scientific method, and that's what you're talking about, when we move away from empirical, measurable evidence, the process of how you arrive at the truth, it is to our detriment. And it's amazing how in 2014 we have to keep talking about that. I'm amazed. I really am, and I'm sure you are too. And
But that's the problem. I think it goes back to the same thing as the knowledge. Is that, you know, we use a cell phone with no appreciation of how it was made,
right?
And we don't understand the intellectual foundations on which our world rests.
Well, we also haven't, most of us don't know what it's like to watch a child die of diphtheria, smallpox, tetanus, measles, whooping cough. That was commonplace. Pick up a history book. Don't worry about a science book. Pick up a good piece of literature or a history book, and the evidence is overwhelming.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, and we have people forget because they don't read, and hopefully we're making a difference on this podcast, ladies and gentlemen, as is Dr. Lewis Dartnell. I can't thank you enough for, I'll let you get to your, you are cooking Coca-Cola. You're taking a ham and you marinated it and cooked it in Coca-Cola. Good luck trying to find that recipe. When the shit hits the fan, my friend. But in the meantime, enjoy living on the grid, and we will keep this book close to us in case, or in my safe, in case things go bad.
What else is in the safe, Brian?
Don't worry about that, Hunter. Don't worry about that.
Where is it? What's the combination,
A lot
Brian?
Of scotch and a sex swing.
What?
Thank you very much, Dr. Lewis Dartnell. We appreciate it. Appreciate you.
Thanks very much, Hunter. Thanks very much, Brian. Cheers.
Take care.
All right, the book is The Knowledge, How to Rebuild Our World from Scratch, Lewis Dartnell. And it's great on the cover. It says, break glass in case of emergency. It's in a glass case. I hope you learned everything, ladies and gentlemen. Peace!
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.